Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
This is Donna from the Jazz on the Air program, Sunday afternoons, 2:30 to 5, with your concert billboard for Tuesday, June 19th. Vertical Horizon will be at the Paramount in Huntington, 8 p.m. Ronnie Abro and Daisy Mayhem will be at the New Haven Green in New Haven, Connecticut, 1 p.m. Your billboard for Wednesday, June 20th. The Liars will be at Webster Hall in Manhattan, 7:30. Philip Glass Ensemble will be at Rockefeller Park in Manhattan, 7 p.m. Blue Devil Big Band will be at Bobby Q in Patchogue, 7 p.m. Crosby, Stills & Nash will be at the NYCB Theater at Westbury, 8 p.m. Live Art Fusion with the Daniel Weiss Group will be at 841 East Lounge, 7:30. Your billboard for Thursday, June 21st. Canyon Blue and Paper Route will be at the Mercury Lounge, Manhattan, 9:30. Mary Mary with Latisse Crawford will be at the Prospect Park Bandshell in Brooklyn, 7:30. Eddie Palmieri will be at Rockefeller Park in Brooklyn. Deer Tick and Johnny Corndog will be at Red Hook Park in Brooklyn, 7 p.m. Crosby, Stills & Nash will be at the NYCB Theater at Westbury. Louise Masri and James O'Malley will be at the Hard Luck Cafe in Huntington, 8:30. Tim Porter will be at Legends Lounge, New Suffolk, 8 p.m. Super Summer Solstice Special with G.P. Lane, George Agnew, Donna Butler, Dan Polhammer, Eddie Ayala, and the Secondhands will be at the Peconic Bay Winery, 6:30. Your concert billboard for Friday, June 22nd. Big Sam's Funky Nation will be at the Stephen Talk House in Amagansett, 8 p.m. Rebirth Brass Band will be at the Bolton Center in Bayshore, 8 p.m. Volbeat, Hell Yeah, and Iced Earth will be at the Paramount in Huntington, 7 p.m. Ringo Starr and his all-star band will be at the Nikon at Jones Beach Theater in Wantagh, 8 p.m. Carrie Carney Band will be at K.J. Farrell's in Belmore, 10 p.m. Soul Doctor will be at the Fishery in East Rockaway, 7 p.m. Unbroken Chain will be at Toomey's Tavern, 9 p.m. in Amityville. Milagro and Seven Turns will be at 89 North, 9 p.m. in Patchogue.
This has been today's Concert Billboard. Tune in each day to hear where your favorites are playing, or maybe try something different. The online Concert Billboard at WUSB.FM has schedules for months ahead, so you can know what to look forward to. And look for WUSB Concert Billboard Group on Facebook for any last-minute shows. The WUSB Concert Billboard is a service of WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM.
I'll hit this harder every week until it gets fixed. Yeah. It's 6:03 with a broken microphone yet again. And you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. The time is 6:03. You know, I'm all flustered now. A little thing like that can really throw you off. All right, hit the button. Let's begin the program. We'll be right back. Okay, I just have to ask, for people listening, please don't reveal the score of today's Euro matches, because I'm halfway through them, and I'm going to watch the rest later, but I don't want to know who won. It's the final game in the group series of the first round, and I guess most people in the States don't know what that means, which is probably good for me, because when it's the World Cup, it's really hard. Sometimes it's in a different part of the world, and you're trying to follow it, and you can't see the whole thing. You have to watch it on delay, and people are running around the streets, and you know, you can tell by their ethnicity. Like, for instance, if I see a bunch of angry-looking Ukrainians later on, I'm going to know what happened, and I got to avoid that at all costs. But World Cup is different because the United States usually qualifies for that, so scores get posted. I've had scores given away on the tops of taxicabs because they're digital now. Cash registers, just people talking in the street, things like that. So Euro is sort of like a mini World Cup, except it only takes place in Europe. And it's interesting to me mostly because of the international aspects of it all. Not so much the game. I don't find myself actually watching the game all that much. Certainly not paying attention to the players, not knowing their statistics or even names, but just kind of watching the way the whole thing works. It's sort of like a train system, the train system they have in Europe, where it's all different countries. It all kind of flows without language, just a machine. And that's how soccer, football as it's known over there, seems to work throughout the world. It's like a language. It's like a machine, I guess. Yeah, it is. Because everybody plays by the same rules. Everybody agrees to certain things. Kofi Annan, you might know him from the United Nations, he expressed envy that there were more members of FIFA than the UN, FIFA being the International Football Association. And it's true. It's incredible how you can get people to agree on something. And that, to me, is what's fascinating. And then seeing how it all plays out, seeing the underdogs. I always root for the underdogs, and that kind of makes it frustrating for me, because my team almost never wins. But it's fascinating just to see the way the whole mechanism is put together. You know, it's so complicated that for me it takes a long, long time to figure out how certain things come into play. For instance, what they do in the group stage, they have 16 teams they start with. And I'm sorry, this show is not going to be about sports. I'm just sort of telling you what's on my mind today. 16 teams, they divide them into four groups of four each. And within those groups, each team plays the other three. So they each play three games. All right? So you got that. And then at the end of three games, they take the top two teams and move them to the quarterfinals. However, it's not that simple, because many times teams have the same number of points, and points, I think we know how points work here. 3 points for a win, 1 point for a tie. Yeah, I know, we don't understand ties in this country. We don't understand a draw, where two teams play for 90 minutes, and there's no winner. To Americans, that's like nothing happening. That's boring. Even though it's really not boring, it's nonstop action. And that's the other thing I don't think we get a handle on, is the nonstop action aspect of this. Every single game that's popular in this country has loads of timeouts and commercials when you're watching it on television. But not so in football, not so in soccer. 45 minutes and a half, you get a 15-minute break, then another 45 minutes, no commercials, nonstop action. Watch the referee in a soccer game. You know, you don't have to be a player to be in shape. The referee is constantly running, keeping up with the... He probably runs more than anybody else because he has to always be where the ball is. So if you just keep an eye on him, you'll see that those guys are really in shape. Now, look at a referee in an American football game. You know, they're 75 years old. They hardly move at all. Everything they say gets amplified over speakers throughout the entire stadium. They get this real sense of entitlement. Umpires in baseball, come on, they don't do anything. They just stand back of home plate and watch balls go through imaginary boxes. It's nothing to compare It's nothing to compare. The amount of activity is simply amazing. So for people to say that 90 minutes that winds up in a scoreless draw, nothing happened, is insane. Constant activity. And that's another thing that kind of makes it alluring to me, is just the almost infinite amount of ways that people can maneuver themselves geometrically just to get a ball to do something. You have all different people trying all different ways to get that ball to go through the goal, and all kinds of ways to prevent it from happening too. And it's like a ballet. It just never stops. No break in the action, and really no break in the action. This sport is something that we're not really familiar with in this country, because so much happens that would not be acceptable. For instance, players getting injured and play continuing on. I've seen games where there's not one but two prone figures on the field not moving while people are on the other side of the field trying to kick the ball through the goal. You know, they just keep going. And they really get slammed lots of times. I mean, you know, backflips over other people and things like that, things you would never see. Certainly not in tennis. They don't do that in tennis. And even American football, they wear all the protection. But I think there's more physical contact in this game where they wear shorts. And the other thing, and this is something, they play the game no matter what. They really do. In the sun, in the heat, in the cold, in the rain, in the snow, they keep going. Now, why is it? Where is it written that if it starts raining in baseball, you have to stop playing? But in soccer, no, you keep going. How come? Why is that? Is it because they're wearing shorts in soccer and they're not going to get quite as drenched in their clothing? Well, why don't baseball players wear shorts? You know, it's who makes these rules? Actually, I should point out, watching the games over the last couple of weeks, there was an exception to that. Last week in the Ukraine, these games are being played in the Ukraine and Poland, two countries I was in the last year as well, which makes it all the more interesting to me. There was such an intense thunderstorm at the beginning of one of the games in, I'm not sure which city in Ukraine it was, but it was raining hard. That wasn't the problem. The problem was when lightning was striking at the stadium, and people were concerned that there might be a lightning strike on the players, so they actually called the game for about an hour and waited for the storm to pass. That is very, very rare. That almost never happens, and they did that. It was really kind of fascinating to see that. But for the most part, nothing stops the game. And, you know, I mentioned the international aspect of all this. It's just fascinating to see all the countries and how they do things differently. For instance, Ireland. I was hoping Ireland might make it through. Instead, they were the first team to get eliminated. It happens, you know. And it's not always fair either, because as of, what was it, yesterday, the day before yesterday, Holland had two losses. Not two losses, and you only play three games. You know, the best they could do is 1-2. They still had a chance to get through, but Ireland didn't, even with the same record. It all has to do with how the other teams do in your group. So the Netherlands had this chance that they could win and actually go through with a record of 1-2. Usually, you need a winning record, or at least not a losing record, to make it to the quarterfinals. So they almost made it, but they didn't. But Ireland, yeah, Ireland lost in the second game. It was apparent they were going to be eliminated. And for the last maybe 20 minutes of that match, their fans were singing their song. Whatever song that was. I don't know if it was the national anthem, or I don't know if it was a football song for the team, but it was something that meant a lot to them. And even though they were losing, even though they were going out of the tournament, that is what their fans who had traveled all the way to Ukraine from Ireland, That's what they were doing for their players, for their team. Now, we don't even have songs. Well, I guess we do have songs, but I hear of songs in college sports. I don't know what our song is. Do we have a song at Stony Brook? I'll play it if we have one, but I've never heard of any kind of a fighting song. Or is it just a surviving song? I don't know. It's a thing that's big over in Europe where they have songs for teams. Every single team in England, and there are hundreds of them, seems to have a song. So in this particular case, they were just singing this song. And that's another thing. They're able to carry a note over there, which I don't think we could do here. They're singing this song constantly for 20 minutes while their team is losing, while their team is being eliminated. And that just, it was emotional. It really was. It shows that it's more than winning. It's about supporting people, supporting your fellow man and the people you support and all that kind of thing. Yeah, supporting the people you support. Well phrased. So that basically is what's been going on over there. And it's cool because so few people here follow it that I can watch my Canadian television and pretty much not worry about scores leaking out before I get a chance to actually see it myself. And the coverage is better too. I've gone on about this before. But this is something I've always had trouble with organized sports. And that's why I don't like organized sports. And I hope I'm conveying that this isn't the organized sports I'm into. It's the whole cultural thing, the whole international meeting of athletes and people, fans from different parts of the world that gather in a different country. That's what it's really about. But when you watch it on a network other than one of the American networks that has all these flashy statistics constantly going and replays and boasting and bragging. You notice that about American television and American radio? It's always boasting and bragging. We were the first to do this. We are the best. We have the best picture. We have the best commentators. We're better than you. You know, all that constantly. Like, they really have to pound it into your head. And what they do on these particular games, which makes it something that I can have on in the background while I'm working and not be constantly wanting to shoot myself, they have one announcer from England. They do the right thing. They have a Canadian intro, and then they go to the people that know how to call the game. They go to England, and they just have one guy there commenting on the match. One guy. Not two, not three. There's none of this banter. You just have one person talking about what's going on in the field, maybe occasionally telling you something that you need to know. And then you have periods where he doesn't say anything at all because there's nothing to say. And those periods of silence, they work better when there's a game in front of you. You can simply watch what's going on. They don't work nearly as well on the radio. But it's something to see and to hear, and you feel like you're not being talked down to. And you feel like you're participating on a world stage. That's the extent of my interest in the whole thing. And today is the last day of the group matches, which means that they played three games. Every team has played three games now, except for the final group, Group D. And right now, Ukraine is playing England. Actually, the games are over now. Ukraine is playing England, and Ukraine is the home team. And Sweden is playing, you should know this. Sweden is playing France. Yes, okay, that's who they're playing. Both England and France can go through if they tie. Ukraine has to win. Sweden has been eliminated. And I've made it up to halftime so far. And what they do is, on the final game, on the third game of the group matches, they play them at the same exact time in two different cities. And the reason for that is because if you play one game first, it's possible that a result that benefits both teams playing second could be something like a tie. In other words, if both teams don't score any goals, or if they just have an even game, they can both go through to the next round. So that would kind of encourage them not to score, not to play to win, or to sort of just bat the ball around for 90 minutes. And that actually has happened in the past. So that's why they play both games at the exact same time, which eliminates that possibility for the most part. But it makes it really hard to watch the games without having the results of the other one ruined. I watch one half of one half of the other. you have to cut it off quickly because sometimes the announcer gives the score of the other game. And then I try to do 15-minute periods of the second half so that it gets exciting. And sometimes, to make it even more interesting, sometimes you hear the crowd start cheering for no reason. And it's because they've heard the result of the other game. And it benefits their team. So they're happy because, well, somebody's losing. And that means that the team they're cheering for is in better shape to go through to the next round. Another thing that happens sometimes the losing team qualifies and the winning team doesn't. And, you know, don't ask me to put it on paper because I can't figure out how it works. But it does happen sometimes. I've seen games where one team wins 2-1 and the losing team is the one jumping up and down at the end of the game because they've heard the other game results went in their favor and they went through to the next round. So it's so incredibly complicated and crazy. Just to give you an example of what happens when things are tied, and this happens a lot, when you have four teams playing only three games, you have lots of instances where everybody has the same number of points at the end. They have to figure out a way to determine who the winner is. So let's see, I printed this out. Hang on, I gotta find, there's a lot of information about this. And it really is insane. The thing is, I can't go online because if I go online, there might be a result, and I don't want to see that. Okay, hang on. Finally, drawn group stage, host selection, qualification, final draw. There is so much about this. Match officials, tie-breaking criteria. Here we go. Let's say that a couple of teams are tied at the end. They both have, say, 4 points. They determine who the winner is by the higher number of points obtained in the matches played between the teams in question. What that means is if there are two teams tied with the same amount of points, they look at the game between those two teams, and if one team beat the other, okay, they're the ones that win because they got more points from a victory than a loss. If they tied, well then, they have to go to the next tie-breaking rule, I guess. And that basically is the goal difference from the matches played between those two teams. But it gets even more complicated if there are three teams tied, because then they have to look at the matches just between those three teams, not between the fourth team, because that doesn't count. So if you beat the fourth team, the one that got eliminated, by a score of, say, 7-0, it doesn't count for your goal difference. Only the three teams that are tied. And it's, you know what, there are 10 different rules here that you go down the list to figure out who the winner is. It is so incredibly complicated. Yet there are people out there who get it immediately, who understand exactly what has to happen. The players understand this. They understand that, okay, we have to score at least 2 goals if we're going to make it through to the next round. But we can't give up 1 goal. If we give up 1 goal, then we have to score 3. And, you know, it changes. The tactics change, and the strategy changes. And that's not even the game. That's just the statistics, just the standings. We don't have anything like that in this country. We just don't. It gets complicated. And, you know, there are some things I don't understand in this country as well on that particular subject, that is. For instance, we mentioned this last week. Stony Brook was in the World Series. Yes. It didn't last long, unfortunately. But, hey, we made it there. We were there in Omaha, Nebraska. And... all right, you know, it was a wipeout both times. It's unfortunate because if you lose twice, you're out of the tournament. But I learned something. I learned a little bit about double elimination tournaments. I didn't know anything about those. Basically, you have 8 teams, and you divide it into 4. Or actually, you divide it into 2. Yeah, 2 halves of 4. And this is the part I can't understand because, all right, if you lose the first game, well, then you have to play 2 more games and win them both in order to meet the team that wins. You know, it's even hard to explain. All I know is I'm looking at the chart of all this, and I see that if you win, it's simple. You meet the winner of the other game. If you lose, you meet the loser of the other game, and then you meet the loser of the game after that. And then you play, assuming you win, you play the winner of the game that you just played the loser of. You see how complicated this is getting? But then there's an extra game after that that says if necessary, and I can't figure out when you play that. It doesn't make any sense to me. And that's all. That's before the actual final series begins. You know, it's tempting to say that people who play sports aren't academic, but you know, you have to have a degree in math to understand all this. You really do. And I'm impressed. And that really is what draws me in more than anything else. It's just figuring out how it all works and seeing it somehow operate and function. But yeah, you know, congrats to the Stony Brook team. A lot of us didn't know we had a baseball team, but yeah, we do. We have teams in all different sports. And they all keep getting better. In fact, if you turn on the Mets game tonight, apparently the Stony Brook Seawolves are being honored right there at Citi Field. They're throwing out the first pitch. Is that right? Wow, I don't think that's ever happened before. You know, they actually, if they're going to do that, if they're going to have them there at Citi Field, why not put them on the field? The Mets are great. They're much better than the Yankees because they don't buy a pennant every year. They actually, it's a team worth rooting for if they don't win all the time. You know, if they lose more times than they win, then you have loyalty when you're behind something like that, right? That's what a team should be. And most teams don't win. You know, and going back to English football, Manchester United, they seem to win all the time, and there's like another 100 teams that don't win, yet they have fans. They have people behind them. So I just think there's something about that. You know, if you have the sense of entitlement where your team always wins, you must not be a very nice person. So yeah, you know, put the Stony Brook Seawolves on the field of Citi Field. See if they do any better than the Mets, because well, they're not doing that good. And who knows? You know, it's another thing I don't understand. I really don't mean to spend all this time talking about sports because I'm not really into sports, which is funny. I'm just into how things work and interoperate with each other. But you have this whole college baseball thing going on, you know, and the thrills and fun that they bring to audiences everywhere. The whole school spirit thing, and of course college football, it's even more massive in other parts of the country. You have something like 100,000 people going to stadiums watching these guys play. And you know what? They're doing it for free. They don't get paid for this. They're college students. They're supposed to be going to school. And here they are playing these sports and playing them to audiences as big as the people who make $1 million a year. I mean, why would you agree to that? Not only do you not get paid, but you're told you got to study and get good grades or you won't be allowed to play anymore. It's not fair. I'm not quite sure how it all ties together. I don't know why there isn't minor league football. You know, it's just all of a sudden college is the minor league and they don't get paid anything for that. They shouldn't. I mean, they're college students, but maybe there should be another division of something. Make it a little bit more fair. So, yeah, a lot of things to think about and consider and mull over. And actually, I've been extremely busy this week, not just thinking about this. This is all stuff that's been going on in the background because I've been extremely busy working on the next conference coming up. And I always know that it's time to work on a conference when something like the World Cup or Euro is going on because that just happens at that time of year. Every 2 years, one of them happens in June. So it kind of gets me into the spirit of putting it all together, of figuring out different things on that level as well. And right now we're working on the schedule for our conference. It takes place July 13th, 14th, and 15th. And we have over 100 talks. people from all over the world coming, talking about technology, social issues, and hacking of various sorts, telephones, you name it. It's all there. And we have to somehow make that work. You know, you ever try coordinating all these people so that everyone's happy? It's a challenge. And it takes about the same amount of time as it does to play the World Cup. That's why it works. And that's why I sort of have gotten into the swing of that, because it just seems familiar somehow. So, yeah, haven't really emerged much to do anything else. Just basically been working and having that on in the background. So all that combined, I don't really know what's going on in the world. I don't think anything major is happening. But I do have a couple of things that I was following. Actually, last week, this was interesting because this was a story last week we didn't get to. And I'm afraid it might evaporate. You know, stories disappear after a while. They really do. You don't hear about them after a year or two, or it's very hard to find that information about them. And, you know, the web is useless. You can't really use that as a legitimate way of finding out what really happened. Online newspapers just don't do it for me. First of all, they're always demanding money. And, you know, I could see, okay, maybe subscribing to one of them, but you can't subscribe to all of them. And if you use Google News to find out what's going on in the world, you click on something and it wants money, what use is that? You're not getting the information that you're looking for. And that happens way too often. But the other thing that happens a lot, which really, I'm sure this has happened to other people too. I think the Daily News is more guilty of this than almost any other newspaper. If you go to the Daily News website, whatever that is, I'm not going to go there now because who knows, they might actually put a score on, which I don't want to see. Not that I think they've ever even heard of half the countries that are playing. But you're reading a story on the Daily News website, and at the bottom it says, you might also be interested in this story. And you click on a story that looks interesting. And you read the whole story, and you say, wow, I can't believe that happened. And then you look at the date. It was 2 years ago. You know, they haven't quite figured out yet how to segregate stories in a timeline. So if something has a similar word or a similar subject matter, it shows up, even if it was a long time ago and there's no date attached to the headline. So you have to look at that tiny print in between the headline and the story to find out when the story actually was printed or put on the web. A lot of sites do that, and I can't believe that's not more of an issue. It's so incredibly annoying. And of course, the other thing, which you know I have a problem with, are the stupid forums that everybody feels compelled to put up, where every imbecile from around the planet spouts off and gets all the attention and takes it away from the story itself. There is not a single subject matter any place that cannot be overshadowed by a simpleton spouting forth whatever stupid fundamentalist, racist, God knows what attitude, blaming Mexicans for everything from the weather to the economy. It's just so incredibly frustrating and annoying. It makes me not read those sites anymore. You don't get that in a newspaper. That's why I still either on a Kindle or in real life, you know, actual paper, it makes it feel like you're actually learning something. It's through the words of a reporter, obviously. So it's one small window into a story, but at least it's not something that you're completely distracted by other things that have nothing to do with what it is you're reading. So anyway, okay. Long way to get to this particular story. This happened about a week ago. I actually was I was driving back from the airport a week ago Monday, a week ago yesterday, and I heard the story on the radio that that a yacht had exploded off the coast of New Jersey. Yeah, kind of serious. And then I heard how Coast Guard was sending boats out. Apparently, they had gotten the call from the captain, and everybody was accounted for. Some people were injured, but they were all on lifeboats, and they were scrambling to bring them all ashore. Hospitals were putting special rooms aside, and everything like that. It was an interesting story, but there were certain troubling aspects to it. Lots of times I listen to stories on the radio and there's no real source given. Something is reported and there's no real meat to the story. So after, say, a half hour, 45 minutes, it was bad traffic. I was there for quite a while. They still didn't have any actual sightings. They still didn't have any actual survivors. They still hadn't gotten to the scene. They couldn't find the wreckage. Meanwhile, every single news outlet throughout, and by the time I got home and started looking on the web, I saw that everybody was reporting that a yacht had indeed exploded. They had the name of it. They had all kinds of information, but none of it was anything that could be validated. No actual names of people, just somewhere off the coast of New Jersey. And the name of a yacht, I think it was called Blind Date or something like that, which means absolutely nothing if you don't have more information than that. And still, they kept going with it. They kept going with the story. Didn't matter at all that they had no information. They just had somebody telling them something in an authoritative voice. And even when they had people from the Coast Guard on the radio saying, yeah, we can't find them. We don't know where they are. You know, right away, that sounds fishy to me. No pun intended. But there they were on the high seas looking for these people. They couldn't find them. They're the Coast Guard, for God's sake. They can find everything. And if you know that something blew up, you're going to see smoke. You're going to see wreckage. You're going to have some indication. You have the name of a boat. You're going to have the location or be able to figure out where they might be. You'll have names of people that owned it, that might have been on it, things like that. None of that was happening. Yet the story kept being reported. Finally, hours later, someone said, you know, this might be a hoax. Oh, really? Wow, the last horse crosses the finish line. Yes, it might be a hoax. You know, that's what I was thinking less than an hour after the thing was announced in the first place. Because of all the absence of real information. But the way our media operates, they don't need that. They don't need the real information. They just need to be told what's going on. And they'll just keep reporting it. In fact, if you go on the web now, you'll find that story is still being reported. Some newspapers or wire services or whatever they're called simply report things and they never actually update them. So this could wind up being logged as something that really happened. Although in all actuality, it'll probably just disappear. Anyway, they say that this whole rescue thing cost about $88,000, lasted for about 4 hours. And now an investigation has begun to determine who was responsible. And the agency is offering a $3,000 reward for prosecution of the person responsible. Usually it's $1,000 or something like that. Now they've tripled it. They say the caller gave authorities a specific blow-by-blow on how the boat was filling up with water. I don't know how hard that is. Many hoax calls, you can tell immediately they're from children. Yeah, I wonder how they do that. That's a neat trick. This one was somewhat calm, but was giving a convincing story as to what the nature of his emergency was. It's called acting. Yeah, people know how to act on the phone sometimes, and they can phone in hoaxes. And yeah, it's a lousy thing to do. But it's not hard to figure out, maybe not right away, but soon, that it's not true. And I don't fault the Coast Guard for this. They obviously have to investigate. But that's their job. That's what they do. They do a good job of it. The media needs to be asking more questions, such as, well, why can't anybody find anything about this? And even while the search was continuing, I mean, it will take the Coast Guard several hours to determine once and for all that, yes, in fact, it is a hoax because God forbid it's not a hoax and they think it is, they have to be very careful. But the media certainly can cast doubt on these things from the start. Always assume something you're told is not the truth. That's rule number one for any journalist, and I think many have forgotten that. Anyway, authorities say the hoax put the public at risk by taking Coast Guard personnel away from a separate emergency call that came in during the four-hour-long search. And there's no word on that emergency either if that was a hoax as well. Making a false distress call, for those of you considering it, is a federal felony with a maximum penalty of 5 to 10 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, and reimbursement to the Coast Guard for the cost of performing the search. Now, who gets the extra $250,000? That's what I want to know. I always wonder about these things, you know? You have to pay back the Coast Guard. Okay, so they get their $88,000 back. And there's no victims that are out on the high seas anywhere, so you don't have to worry about them. There might be victims in other places because you called all these people away and they didn't have first responders to respond to them, but that's theoretical. But paying $250,000, where does that go? How does that benefit the rest of us? Anyway, I don't think they found the guy yet. I don't think they have any idea what's... And that's something that should be followed up on as well. How's that investigation going? Are we just going to forget about it? Or who's actually out there making false calls like this? It's something else. It really is. What else we have going on? Well, supposedly... Oh, this is cheery news, isn't it? The Coca-Cola Foundation has its eyes on Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. I don't know why everyone always feels compelled to say that. I'm sorry for doing it myself. Other countries change their names, and they don't constantly say what the old name was. You know, Iran, formerly known as Persia. Sri Lanka, formerly known as Ceylon. Okay, you know, they changed their name a long time ago. What, 20 years ago now? Burma became Myanmar? I know a lot of people don't agree that it should be called Myanmar, but it is. The people in charge of the country say that's what it is. And they can call it Disney World for all we're concerned. That's if they're in charge of the name, then we call it what they say it is. I'm not sure how that works either, but it seems if we're going to call it Myanmar, we should just stop there and not give a history lesson every single time. Anyway, apparently, since Myanmar has been opening up a little bit, and this is probably why they weren't opening up for 60 years, the Coca-Cola Foundation is jumping in and planning to return to the country for the first time in more than half a century. Coke has applied for a general license to begin conducting business there. Myanmar was the once reclusive nation as of only a few months ago. It's one of three countries in the world where Coca-Cola does not do business. One of three countries. And you know what the other two are? I've been to both. Cuba and North Korea. Yeah. Isn't that something? They do business everywhere else in the world, but not those three. Well, Myanmar maybe soon, but not Cuba, not North Korea. Fascinating. Myanmar's government is opening up to international investors as it undergoes a series of reforms. And, of course, the United States, the EU, and others are easing sanctions. But, you know, as a side effect to all that, you're going to get Coke. No word on Pepsi yet, but I'm sure that's down the road a little bit, too. Here's a letter that we got this week. And you can write letters, too. Write them to OTW. Which stands for Off the Wall, at 2600.com. That's OTW at 2600.com. And tell us what's on your mind. Tell us what you think of the things that are broadcast on this particular show and maybe things that you think should be broadcast, things that have happened in your life, perspectives, that sort of thing. There's no reason why. It just has to be me ranting and raving for an hour. It can be almost anyone. Here's somebody who wrote into us. I've been listening to the Off the Hook, Off the Wall podcast for a couple of years now, and I really enjoy them. And yes, we are a podcast, but we're also a broadcast on a radio station, Off the Hook on WBAI, Off the Wall on WUSB. I think that adds to the magic, the fact that we're broadcast from a real radio studio. Yeah, things are falling apart, but it is real, and it does go out over a transmitter. That's what I hear, anyway. I especially enjoyed listening to you recount your recent trip to the NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. That was a week ago today. On last week's show, we talked about that. I work for a theatrical lighting contractor in Maryland, and I've had the dubious pleasure of having on-site meetings at a lot of the federal agencies in the D.C. Baltimore area, including the NSA, the National Security Agency. Most recently, I visited the guys at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, which isn't that far from Fort Meade. Now, NASA Goddard was one of the more painless Fed experiences I've had. To get into the facility, we just had to stop at a visitor center just inside the gate, provide our photo IDs, vehicle information, receive our escort-only ID badges, and then meet with our official escort. Kind of like going to North Korea, I guess. All of that was worth it, in my opinion, because our escort gave us a little tour of the place after our meeting. We got to see the mission control room where they fly the Hubble Space Telescope and walk around inside one of the biggest centrifuges I've ever seen. We were told that an auto manufacturer once strapped an SUV to it in order to do some stress testing on the SUV. Yeah, okay, that's neat. We also saw, but weren't allowed to enter, the world's largest clean room facility. It's basically a five-story building, one wall of which is an air filter. And they're currently building the new Webb Space Telescope in there. And you can see pictures from inside the facility on their webcam. And it's spelled W-E-B-B, so it's a little different. But their website is www.jwst.nasa.gov/webcam.html. In that particular case, it's spelled with one B, W-E-B-C-A-M.html. The big pink wall in the right side image is the air filter. I would go there right now, except, you know, with my luck, NASA would suddenly say something about how the game went today in Euro, and I'll go there tomorrow, I promise. Anyway, in general, it seems like my experience at NASA Goddard was a lot more positive than yours was at Fort Meade. Yeah, well, we sort of got a little interrogated at Fort Meade, but I guess, you know, you haven't visited the NSA unless you get interrogated and looked at quite a bit. That's sort of what it's all about. Maybe you should make your next trip to Greenbelt. I would definitely like to do that. It sounds like a blast. Anyway, about the NSA, while it's possible for civilian contractors to get into NSA's facility at Fort Meade, it is unsurprisingly a process that's a bit more involved than the one that at NASA Goddard. It's been a few years since I had a meeting there, but it was definitely after 9/11, so I imagine the security policies are at least as rigorous today as they were then. Now, just getting to the visitor center, that will require you to submit to a pretty thorough search of your vehicle at the gate. One officer will check your ID and registration, while others are peering under your car to make sure you haven't got any contraband or ninjas under there. You may also have to let them open your trunk, glove box, and all sorts of other compartments that you might not even have known existed. The guards at the gate are just like the ones you met, young, clean-cut, polite, and heavily armed. Yes, most definitely. As you noticed, you aren't supposed to even think about bringing in a cell phone, laptop, camera, notebook, the paper kind, that is, or any other type of recording or transmitting device. Leave all that crap in your car and follow your escort into the building for processing. Now, as with other federal facilities, you'll need to provide a photo ID and fill out some forms about who you are, who you're visiting, and why, etc. Your escort will need to countersign these for you, and if you're just visiting for a day, as I was, you probably won't have to submit to a background check. If you need more than an escort-only badge, though, you'll probably want to allow a week or so for all that paperwork to go through, and then allow yourself a few days on top of that so you can complete the paperwork. Wow. Now, once the forms are processed, you step into line for hand/palm/fingerprint scanning. Now, you might want to moisturize your hands for a few days ahead of time. My hands were pretty dry the day I visited, so it took a good 15 minutes before they got a usable scan from me. Now, after all this, you'll be ready to follow your escort to whatever unsecure parts of the facility you are allowed to see that day. And our letter writer adds, congratulations, if you weren't on file with the feds before this, you are now. Now, if you're wondering what a theatrical lighting contractor is doing visiting places like NASA and the NSA and all sorts of other federal agencies, it's because every one of these agencies has at least one auditorium and at least one video production slash teleconferencing center. And some of these haven't been updated since the 1970s, so they've been coming to us to talk about installing new LED lighting, moving lights, computerized controls, etc. We don't always get the job, but it's been kind of neat to visit places that would typically be off limits to me and other civilians. Well, thanks very much for, you know, I'm not going to read your name, even your first name, because I'm afraid that there are operatives listening that might see that and say, aha, that's this guy. And that's his company or her company. Yeah, could be either. And we're not going to do business with them again because they talk too much. So thanks for the letter. It's an amazing experience that you've been through. Thanks for sharing. And this is exactly the kind of letter that makes doing the show worthwhile. Thanks so much for writing in and sharing that. Because we all go through different things in life. And I try to share as much as I can with the experiences that I have in various parts of the world, but I want to hear what listeners are doing as well. That's extremely important. Okay, you know what? I did not have the delay set up, so I can't go into delay, unfortunately. But it's probably for the best, because someone might say something that I don't want to hear, you know? And sometimes people say things about, you know, scores and stuff that it's unintentional. They might talk about rioting in England. Actually, you know what? They'd be rioting in England if they won or lost. So I guess that's not a giveaway right there. But there are other things that might just, even saying the game was good is too much of a giveaway for me. You know, so I kind of have to be isolated and not look at anything or talk to anybody. So this is actually the ideal place for me right now, is just in a dark room talking into a microphone that sometimes doesn't even work. I do want to encourage people to send material in to us, otw@2600.com. We will definitely take phone calls next week. I think I can guarantee that. And we have material from the UK that we'll be airing in the weeks ahead as well. We've talked to a number of people over there. And of course, we also will have more information on the Hackers on Planet Earth conference coming up. If you want more information, by the way, on that, simply go to www.hope.net. We'll be finalizing the schedule in the next couple of days, so that'll be posted as well. But in the meantime, you can go there and see the various talks that have been put on the schedule, not day and time yet, but these talks will definitely be presented. So go to www.hope.net and you'll see some of what we have coming up in just less than a month. Yeah, July 13th, 14th, and 15th. And we have two keynotes. The most recently announced keynote is William Binney, and he was a former NSA analyst. Yeah, there's a real NSA theme lately, isn't there? And this guy is incredible. This guy worked for the NSA for, I think, 30 years. And then when he saw that that their technology was being used against their own country. In other words, NSA was formed to spy on foreign governments and suspicious people overseas. Like it or not, that's what it was formed to do. To spy on foreigners. But after 9/11, they started turning those monitoring ears towards Americans, both inside this country and outside this country. And that was too much for William Binney, and he left the NSA and became a whistleblower. And I saw him recently at a presentation at the Whitney Museum, and it was just incredible. He had the audience transfixed. It was simply amazing to hear what goes on inside that place. And that's kind of what made me determine to head down there with Kyle and get some pictures for the upcoming 2013 surveillance camera. It's a surveillance camera. Wow. No, 2013 surveillance calendar. Actually, it's a hacker calendar with a theme of surveillance. How's that? So yeah, it all ties together. You know, we go through these experiences and they all, one leads to another. I knew as soon as I saw this guy that he was perfect to be talking to people at the hacker conference, because you have all these people who are facing the same questions, whether they're kids, whether they're full-grown adults. The question of doing the right thing, the question of just because this is where we're heading as a society, is it right? Is it right to do this to my fellow citizens? Do we want to have the kind of society where we're always watching each other? And do we want to keep it secret? Or do we want to take a chance and speak out? Yeah, it might cost you your job. It might even cost you your freedom. What is the right thing to do? What is the wrong thing to do? And how do you work that out inside your head? These are the questions that people growing up today are going to have to deal with. And I guarantee you, the level with which they deal with these questions will affect millions and millions of people. We've seen so many attendees at our conferences go on to do absolutely incredible things, develop all kinds of technologies, start companies, influence policy. So yeah, you better believe someone like William Binney is a person they need to hear from. And then, of course, our other keynote address is from the Yes Men. And these guys are probably the most fun you'll have on this planet if you just pay attention to what they're doing. The way they're able to infiltrate corporations and impersonate corporations, make announcements of things that corporations would never do, but which are the right things. They fool the media. They do their own hoaxes. They don't put people's lives at risk, but they certainly get attention worldwide, and they are global heroes as far as I'm concerned. And they're giving the other keynote address. We have two really amazing keynote addresses coming up at the Hope Conference next month, and so many other talks as well. Like I said, about 100 talks altogether. And in addition to that, a lot of space, a lot of toys, a lot of technology, a lot of people to meet and hang out with for a weekend. The weekend is July 13th through 15th. It's at the Hotel Pennsylvania, New York City. It's right across the street from Penn Station. And again, more information, www.hope.net. We're out of time. You know, I don't know where the time goes. I've just been ranting and raving for an hour. Pay attention. Watch what's going on in the world. Here's a perfect example. We don't pay attention to what's going on in the world so many times, even with music. This was the number one hip-hop song of all time. And how many times have you heard this? Yeah, take a listen. See you next week.
This is S-Stop Mouse, Smouse, with some very important information. I want you to get your elbows out and slap them.
Slap my elbow, you do it like this. Slap my elbow, you do it like this. I slap my elbow, slap my ball, slap my elbow.
Slap it on the right, slap it on the left. Check my phone, what's your address? My money is right. My homies in the ghetto, they is doing alright. So slap it up,
your elbow.
So slap it up,
your elbow.
S-M-O-U-S-C is moving it right. Not your shoulder or your knees, it's your elbow, right?
Slap my elbow, you do it like this. Slap my elbow, you do it like this. I slap my elbow, slap my ball, slap my elbow.
Check my phone. I got an SMS telling me to slap my elbow. So I slap my elbow. Now I'ma show you how to
slap my elbow. You do it like this. Slap my elbow. You do it like this. I slap my elbow, slap my ball, slap my elbow.
Step one, put your arm in front. Step two, get your elbow ready. Step three, slap it hard. So slap it hard.
Slap my elbow, you do it like this. Slap my elbow, you do it like this.
Slapping whenever you're feeling down, alone in your bedroom, or even in the club with a girl, or walking the dog. Get your elbows out, kids, and just slap them. Follow my three steps. This is a S-Stop Mouse, Smouse. Slap it up, kids, yeah.